hearing from Dr. Jim Burkitt. Jim is a physical chemist. He gained his PhD at Yale University. In 1962, he joined the international consulting firm Arthur D. Little, and if my maths is correct, that means Jim has been in the industry for 50 years, which is quite some achievement. He formed his own consultancy in 1988. That's a consultancy called Westmec Strategies, which is based in Maine in the U.S., and it was shortly after 1988 that I first came across Jim in his consultancy role when I visited Boston to ask about various membrane issues. Jim has been involved for 40 years in the study of desalination and advanced water treatment and membrane separation. He provides technology support in strategic planning exercises and competitive analysis in evaluating commercial viability of new processes and process modifications. He's widely recognized in the desalination field and consults part-time, as well as lecturing and publishing widely. He's got a particular interest in the history of desalination prior to 1950, and that historical context will be a very valuable introductory piece for us in this afternoon's presentations. So I can think of no better person to take this scene-setting initial presentation than Jim. So Jim, can I hand over to you for the first presentation?
Yes, Graham, and thank you very much for those kind words. I have known about membrane distillation for quite a while and have viewed it in its usual embodiments as a heat recovery thermal system. That is, the heat of condensation, vaporization is reused by heating the feed stream. If we go to my first slide, we see the diagram with which I think everybody in the web audience is familiar of in one form or another. Until recently, most membrane distillation configurations could be reduced to what you see before you. The feed goes in, I hardly even need to use the laser pointer, where it says feed into a condenser channel. It is heated by heat passing up through the heat exchange surface, so it emerges from the condenser channel at a higher temperature, goes into a heat input, we'll call it a heat exchanger because that is what it usually is. Additional external heat is added, it then enters the evaporator channel at the highest temperature it will see. Vapor, water vapor passes through what is the red barrier here, which is a microporous hydrophobic membrane, and condenses on the heat exchange surface above it, the blue line, which is kept cold by the feed water passing. Then the product water exits to the right, and the concentrated brine exits to the right. As I said, most membrane distillation systems can be reduced to this basic process, which can be considered analogous, really, to once-through multi-stage flash with an infinite number of stages. So let's just identify a few temperatures and flows. We don't have to deal with all of them. We just pick a few critical ones, which include, of course, W, the feed water flow rate, the product water flow rate, and we're going to pick three temperatures here. The temperature of the feed. Yes, the temperature of the feed. The top temperature as the feed enters the brine heater. The temperature as it exits the heater. And then, of course, we have the amount of heat which is added to the heater. And then two constants, relative constants, the heat capacity, specific heat of the feed water, and the heat of vaporization. Now notice that C sub P and H sub V are both essentially constant over the temperature ranges we're talking about. So let's just take these flows and temperatures and reinsert them into the diagram. As you might think, the feed temperature and flow rate here, the temperature entering the heater, temperature exiting the heater, and for this analysis, that is all you need to know, because this is a very basic thermal analysis, which is the, well, which is reducing it to its simplest state. Now, the percent recovery, as we all know, is the fraction of the feed which is converted into the useful product, and expressed as a percent, it is 100 times the product flow rate divided by the feed flow rate. Now, if we make the assumption that the feed stream is heated only by the condensation of water vapor, no thermal short circuits, no heat passing through by conduction, then the heat added between the feed inlet and the heater inlet must be, of course, the flow rate times the temperature rise times the heat capacity, which must also equal the amount of product which condenses on the surface and the heat there, which is the Q, the product rate, times the heat of vaporization. Solving one for the other, or flipping the equation, you suddenly realize that the percent recovery is now 100 times the heat capacity times the temperature rise divided by the heat of vaporization. Cp and Cv are relatively constants. So the limiting value, assuming no losses for the percent recovery, can be determined by this equation. Now, the other factor we want to calculate is the gained output ratio, GOR. This is a common parameter in thermal systems. It's equal to the number of units of product which are produced per units of steam or heat equivalent. So the GOR, therefore, is the heat of condensation of the total product flow, which is Q times the heat of vaporization, divided by the heat input to the heater, which is the flow times the heat capacity times the temperature rise in the heater. Putting these together, we get the bottom bullet. You can go back at your leisure and review these, but I think you'll find that they line up correctly. We've already determined in the calculation of percent recovery that W times T2 times minus T1 times T sub P is equal to the product flow rate times the heat of vaporization. So we substitute this into the third bullet on the preceding page, and we get this, which is sort of intermediate. But you notice that we can now cancel out T sub P, we can cancel out W, and we end up with the GOR is determined by two temperature differences. We only need to know three temperatures to determine the limiting GOR, and that's with no heat losses, no other inefficiencies, and a perfect membrane. If we take what we've just determined, if we go back to this and summarize it, for simple heat recovery systems, the limiting values of both percent recovery and GOR may be approximated by knowing only three temperatures. And these are dimensionless ratios. You may do your calculations in joules or BTUs or kilocalories or ergs. It doesn't matter. As long as you are internally consistent with your use of units, this will work out. Now, here's a good example. Many examples of membrane distillation seen in the literature are given with T1 of about 20, T2 of about 72, T3 of about 80. And going in small calories, C sub P is 1 calorie per gram per degree, and C sub V, heat of vaporization, is 450. So for this particular model, if we were to have a perfect membrane distillation system operating here, we would calculate a percent recovery of 9.6 and a GOR of 6.5, maximum. If we were to achieve even as much as 80% of perfection, we'd be down around 8% for a percent recovery and down around 5 or 5.5 for the GOR. So how does this measure up? little table of the technologies we list are multi-stage flash, recirculating mode, the currently popular multi-effect distillation combined with thermal vapor compression, seawater RO, and this particular membrane distillation model. It doesn't measure up very well, and these are the limiting values. The examples also given of MSF, MED, and SRO are operating at higher feed water temperatures and agreed higher top end process temperatures. MSF and MED can operate down in at much lower temperatures, but for reasons of efficiency and productivity, they choose not to. The early MSF in the popular Middle East operated at the top temperature range of about 90 C sub-boiling, and last stage would be at about 40 C. But for reasons of economy, modern plants always choose to operate at a higher temperature. When the trade-off is higher cost energy at high efficiency versus lower cost energy at low efficiency, the former option usually wins out. So what's the message? The message, I think, is that membrane distillation research should be focused on improving the GOR and percent recovery, because that is what the customer ultimately is going to be most interested in. A perfect God-given membrane will not let you surpass the inherent limits imposed by temperature. To improve, there are only two things you can do. One would be to increase the temperature differential, T2 minus T1, operate a higher top end, as the highest top end as you can, or operate with a lower temperature feed. It sounds counterintuitive, but all evaporative processes are much more efficient operating at a low temperature feed. Or, and what you will learn more about in the following presentations, is to pursue new configurations from multi-effect operation rather than simple heat recovery alone. Multi-effect, you operate under different restraints. The restraints I've given are only for heat recovery, but that is where, up until the present time, most of the membrane distillation research has gone. So I think you'll be intrigued by some of the following presentations, which push these boundaries. All right, that is all I have to say by way of introduction, and back to you, Graham.
Okay, thank you very much, Jim. That was an extremely good presentation of the basics of membrane distillation. What we're now going to do is to move on to an engineering firm's view from Dr. Val Frankel. Val is currently Director of Membrane Technologies at Malcolm Perney, which is the water division of Arcadis. He's worked for many years in the development of low-pressure membrane technologies and applications. He has an extensive list of publications, including book chapters, manuals of practice, patents, papers, and so on. And he is well-known on the desalination conference circuit. So I'm going to pass over now to Val to tell us about various process configurations, process options that engineering firms have looked at for membrane distillation technology. Val, over to you.
Thank you, Graeme, and good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to everyone. Depends on what part of the world you're located. The first presentation, Jim, it was an outstanding presentation on the theoretical basis for the MD, or membrane distillation process, and now within a short allowed to me time frame, I will provide some overview from the engineering standpoint on the membrane distillation process. So I will try really touch the process itself, the major techniques, the benefits, the drawbacks, applications, what would be the expected market niche for that technology in some summary, and later on at the end of that webinar we will go to the questions and answers. So today we know five major configurations of the membrane distillation, and I'll show you the schematic how that works. Actually, the first one, the basic one, is a direct contact membrane distillation, what's called DCMD. The second one, air gap membrane distillation, AGMD. The third one is vacuum MD or VMD, sweeping gas MD or SWGMD as the fourth one. And vacuum multi-effect membrane distillation is actually the configuration of the vacuum MD process. The direct membrane distillation is actually when they cross the membrane from one side, it's a hot solution, is applied from other side of the membrane, they directly apply the cold solution, and the process really takes place on the surface of the membrane using the thermal gradient between the two temperatures, and Jim already in the first presentation alluded how that is happen and how it processes. The air gap, it's a very similar process, however there is a boundary of air is created to minimize some negative effect of the cold solution on a membrane surface. The vacuum process is instead of cold solution, the vacuum is applied, so that allows to increase the driving forces to create the vapor on the membrane surface comparing to just using the liquid solution. And the sweeping gas, it's similar to air, just the sweeping gas is applied. It's a similar concept as an air process. And the last one is the vacuum multi-effect distillation. It's very similar, as I already mentioned, as a vacuum MD. So what's really the benefits of the membrane distillation, and one why it attracts the attention lately within number of years, last few years, probably 5, 6, 7, more and more. It's a low maintenance process. It can be operated using waste heat on sunlight, and it's a very simple process. It operates at ambient temperature or pressure, and it has relatively low fouling. Why those all listed five we're considering as the benefit? Because today as a commercial, we're still applying and using two major processes. One is a thermal desalination, and another one is the reverse osmosis desalination. And both processes are relatively energy intensive and not the low cost processes. The drawback of the membrane distillation is actually the part or result of the technology's limitations. First of all, it's a relatively low production of the water or flux per membrane area. In that case, if you will recalculate or will try to recalculate the economics of the process, it may end up as a result relatively high capital cost per unit of the produced water. And difficult to scale for a large centralized desalination facility in terms of footprint, at least today, where we stand with development of the technology, and we hope that that will change in the near future. What's the market, expected market niche? Most likely it's a small and medium-sized plants and facility, not the large plants. The decentralized desalination and remote location with the limited energy supplies. Future work should be focused on the technology limitations and comparing to the benchmark where the current commercial desalination processes stand are. And first of all, that probably the membrane configuration. It's still open area. What would be the membrane configuration to increase or improve economics of the entire process? Should that be the flat sheet membrane, the hollow fiber, or spiral wound? and that relates to the cost of the membrane or manufacturing facility and so on. And the efficiency of the process itself depends on what configuration the membranes are. And definitely the membrane materials. As an example, the RO or reverse osmosis is already commercial within last 3-4 or almost 5 decades. The significant improvement in RO membranes were made, while still there is a way to go in the MD membrane materials. Recovery is a theoretical limitation on the technology. And what may happen that membrane distillation may play a good role and fit in a combination with other processes. It's a hard to say, but may happen that the same MED, which is now one of the benchmark comparing the features and benefits of membrane distillation, can be combined with a membrane distillation in the future to recover tail of the process. And with that, I conclude a very brief overview within our allowed time frame, and we'll pass the presentation to the next speaker.
Okay, Val, thank you very much for your presentation. What we're going to do now is to move on to Albert Janssen. Albert is responsible for business development at the Dutch research organization TNO. TNO has done a lot of work within water and energy in developing new technologies, and in the Netherlands in general, there's been a lot of work on membrane technology research. One of the developments undertaken by TNO has been that specifically of membrane distillation, and this technology has been licensed to the Dutch company Memstil. Albert is chair of the Dutch Membrane Organization. He's also a member of various EU boards and advisory groups and Dutch groups with names which are far too complicated for an Englishman to pronounce, so I won't even try. But with that, Albert, I'll hand over to you, and we'd like to hear your presentation on new technological developments in desalination. Thank you.
Thank you, Graham. Hello to you all. On my first slide, I presented new technological developments in desalination. And first, I would like to discuss the word desalination, because as you have seen by the principle of this process, it's not a desalination at all. It's a dewatering process. And later on, with the impact of membrane distillation, I think that these dewatering applications are the best applications to have impact for the short time. So here, from this slide, I show you the one of the major advantages of this membrane process over other membrane processes. Here you see the effect of some fouling and scaling in this and you see that the flow of this scaling is going to zero. After rinsing this membrane with warm water, we see recovery of this flow coming again to 100%. So that's an aspect you cannot see in reverse osmosis processes. Then Val already mentioned the principle that you can make membrane distillation several configurations, and within TNO we've done so. On the left side you see a hollow fiber membrane module was the first developed, 10 by 10 centimeters. Above you see the spiral wound. And below that, you see a flat sheet. For that, we had many, many discussions and still going on. Which of those three are the best for scaling up? And all of them can be scaled up, but the question is which one can be the lowest cost. And still, this is not figured out yet. For that, I see two principles on the road. One is flat sheet screw, and the other is spiral one. Well, here you see models we within TNL we scaled up to 300 square meters membrane surface area. That's additional surface areas for condensers and. And test in Singapore, this technology is tested, and there we tested it on a capacity of 1 cubic meter. We did it at a power production site of E.ON, and the background of this pilot plant you see the site with the power plant of E.ON where it was tested. And then we here I want to show you the last figure on the side, and that shows you the electric conductivity. And you see that the feed water, which was the North Sea water, has a very high conductivity. And the distillate, the product, was less than one. So that is a separation efficiency, which cannot be reached by reverse osmosis in a one-step approach. And it's even very, very good quality water, because it is almost the quality for boiler feed water for that production site. So we're making a better water quality than these feed water. Then after that, we did development to several wastewater applications. In this case, you see a picture where some dairy packages are on the floor. Here we do simulate wastewater from a hospital, because we didn't want to test water with the blood inside, but we wanted to have the same type of molecules in there. But we do many, many industrial projects where some advantages are technology. So, to summarize, we see many environmental advantages. The first one is that no additives are necessary. The second one is that there is a low recovery and therefore a very low brine increase of the retentate. For that reason, it is very easy in your license to get rid of this retentate, but it's not the case when you have concentrated brines. Then we have minor feed pretreatment, a small footprint, no corrosion, and no CO2 emission. The last point, I think that's one of the points for discussion within the other speakers, is that it is still, to my opinion, a very high energy consumption, 200 to 500 megajoule per cubic meter, but for reason that this heat can be gotten at very low cost, it's no problem. But when there are high costs for energy, it should be further reduced. And then for the economics, I've made an additional slide, which I will explain now. Here you see a table of four NEMSTIL applications from left to right. We start with fossil fuels as the only energy source, and you see below that 70 cents for a cubic meter is a cost which is comparable to the state-of-the-art large-scale reverse osmosis plants, so there's no advantage there. But when you go to cogeneration, then you see already that the cost of your water product is much lower. And then we go to waste heat, then you have additional advantages over there. Another thing which you can see from this slide is that the hardware cost, which was already mentioned by earlier speakers, is indeed higher than for reverse osmosis, because when you have low operational costs, low energy costs, and you have comparable costs with your competing technology, you will still see that those costs are those costs for the hardware are higher than for reverse osmosis. Then, as you can see in the top of this page, this is an evaluation done for very large-scale desalination plants, which cannot be built today. And for that reason, we had to make assumptions about the cost of the membranes and cost of the equipment and more of those things. And nowadays, when you want to start a small-scale MEMSteel plant, the membranes, because they are bought at a very low volume, have much higher prices than reverse osmosis today. So for that reason, the small-scale applications at this stage of the development are still much higher than the competing technologies. And that learns us two things, that if you want to come to the market and you want to have a competitive edge, you should go to applications where reverse osmosis are not working, or you should where distillation is a too small scale. And from my opinion, that are industrial processes. You see the two names of the companies who have licensed the technology and are now further optimization their production technology, and where membrane distillation models can be bought. And you will see from one of those licensees pilot plants, which was tested for a sugar mill for dewatering sugar floods, just as an example of new applications. I also see nice opportunities for small-scale applications for point of use in house. But the quality as desired, you can treat it yourself, only the... several of those advantages, so I don't want to... It's a very important technology. Then you can be paid for two times in industry, and then your process take off. This and I've seen our way. Then my last. You end up with brines, and more countries come with policies, and for that reason, installation and crystallization process as a possible solution to further dewater brines, and at the same time do crystallization without precipitation. The results there that further developed. And the only reason is when you have to reduce the top temp, but up to now it is not economic to do so, because when you use waste heat then there's no reason to do that. But when you use solar heat, this could be advantageous. So this is the end of my presentation.
Okay, thank you very much, Albert. I'm afraid we had a little bit of an audio problem with your phone towards the end there, so you were dropping out and then coming back in. So I hope that people were able to follow on the slides at least. So hopefully that'll be sorted out by the time we get to the Q&A. So now, thank you very much, Albert, for your presentation, and I now want to move to our final panelist presenter, who is Gertz Langer from Germany. Gertz has worked for 13 years in the water sector. Within water, he's had roles in decentralized water supply technologies, grey water recycling, and rainwater harvesting. He was also responsible for the establishment of AdBlue storage and distribution systems in Europe prior to his involvement there. Since 2009, Gertz has been a managing partner at the German membrane distillation specialist MEMSIS, and at MEMSIS he's responsible for the commercial business of the operation. And Gertz is going to talk to us about innovative thermal separation processes, i.e. membrane distillation. Thank you, Gert.
Ladies and gentlemen, just one moment here. It appears we are having an audio issue here again. Gertz, is your phone line muted on your end?
Am I in now?
Okay, yeah, we can hear
Hello?
You now.
Okay, sorry. Right. Okay, so I go back to the state. Nobody could hear me at all, right?
Yeah, not at all.
Okay, so sorry for that. So... thanks, Graham, for handing over. I'm particularly thankful for the comments made by the three panelists before me. Because they exactly point on the problems and the limitations of FMD, and I would like to explain that we took our developments at MEMSIS exactly at these limitations and try to overcome these limitations and hopefully get it to the better end. Now, my first slide is more or less like summarizing the comments which have already been made by the others. I would like to point out two special benefits of the membrane distillation. Firstly, the operation at very high salt concentrations. The MD generally is not limited by osmotic pressure, so we run trials up to very, very high salt concentrations, And this will lead us to niche markets which are very attractive for MD. Now, secondly, we believe that we cannot overcome physics with membrane distillation. So whatever has been seen with other thermal separation processes like MSF or MED, we will see similar energy consumption rates in membrane distillation as well, or recovery rates. The main difference is that with the help of the membrane, we can reduce the vapor space between the liquid and the between the liquid and the condensation, and with this will allow us to convert membrane distillation into a modular concept, and this is one of the major driver of our development. So sorry, I have my problems here as well. So to assure the right configuration of within this process, and to assure the right thermodynamic process, we have to make sure that a few, let's say, basic configurations have to be designed into membrane distillation modules. The first part is that we need to use ultra-thin polypropylene foils to assure a very, very good and efficient heat transfer within the modules. Unfortunately, my laser pointer is not working, so you can see this very thin foil as a yellow bar on the left-hand side and the right-hand side of the diagram. Now, this thin foil and the membrane, which is the gray barrier on the other side of the seawater feed channel, these form the basic channel for the process. Now, in our process, we heat up the feed through the polypropylene foil. Vapor passes through the membrane and enters a channel in which we form a vacuum. On the other side, we see the second, on the right-hand side, we see a second polypropylene foil. On this foil, the vapor condenses, and with condensing, the condensing energy is transferred to the next stage. Now, we transport latent heat with the steam, and this makes the process from the energy recovery, that enhances our energy recovery process. The combination of the vacuum and the chosen thermodynamic process leads to our vacuum multi-effect membrane distillation process, which we will see on the next slide. So I hope that the animation works. What we see in this animation is, on the left-hand side, we see a first module stage where where the steam the steam raiser unit produces the steam for the process. On the right-hand side, we see a cooling, the cool side of the process, which is the condenser, and we produce the vacuum via this condenser for the process. Now, when we apply vacuum to the system, we can when we apply vacuum to the system, we can form a multi-effect process within a set of membrane distillation modules. And the beauty of this concept, again, is that that we do not need any specific controls, any complicated mechanisms or valves to control the process over the different effects. The effect is a self-adjusting process driven by the vacuum applied by the top temperature from the heat source, whether this is solar or waste energy, and the cool side. So these three parameters are define the driving forces for the process. Now, Mendes' idea was from the very beginning to look specifically on a product design which allows us to produce membrane distillation modules in an industrial way. The scalability of the modules will be key to success within this market, where the cost as well on the CapEx side and on the OpEx side play an important role. So all processes within the Mendes process are done and provided by one single injection molding tool, which you see here. We have all the piping and ducting incorporated into this frame, and once we weld several of these frames together, we form a block or a stage, which then leads to either steam raisers, evaporating stages, or condensers. So the key goal for it's definitely to turn the heavy industry of thermal separation technologies into a modular concept. What you can see on the right hand side is a typical design on a handful of frames. We're flexible with the frames. We're flexible with the number of effects that can be brought together to form the thermodynamic process. This is a very brief look into our production to indicate that we took the hurdle on serial production already. Both processes, injection molding and welding, it's done by producers from the automotive sector. So high quality and high volumes are key to the chosen production process. So taking up the comment from Jim from the very beginning, yes, it is very right that the core numbers are the energy recovery and the recovery rate of the brine and feed relation. Unfortunately, these two numbers are working in exactly in the opposite direction. So the higher the achieved bore in the unit, the lower the flux per square meter appears. And this is what we can see from this first graph. We run our processes with various numbers of effects. You can see on the top of the graph, you can see a two effect unit. Where the driving forces of the temperature delta are the highest, we achieve the highest fluxes on these units, of course. And then the higher the bore number turns out, by adding more effects to the individual modules, the lower the flux becomes. Nevertheless, in the long run, we see GOR numbers achievable similar to where traditional thermal separation technologies like MED are today as well. So in laboratory mode, we could achieve GOR 10 and a bit more already. This slide indicates one of the big advantages that we see. This is a trial run that we performed with sodium chloride. We ran in one process steps from concentration levels at 60 grams per liter up to saturation level at 240 grams per liter. The product quality was with 2 microsiemens extremely good. And we see exactly at this point one of the huge benefits of the NEMD process. So one of the focuses is not to compete against RO on low salinity water levels. We see the beauty spots more towards zero liquid discharge applications. And the very good cleaning characteristics, which Albert mentioned already, will support if any scaling appears. Cleaning will be much easier than with known thermal separation technologies. So this is a trial to allocate the market for the membrane distillation processes. Please don't nail me down exactly where the position will be, but you can see that we position us clearly at the level and the complexity of water treatment where typically RO might end. As long as membrane prices are where they are, and before the economies of scale for this technology really kick in, we see the beauty spots for MD being a bridging technology between existing separation technologies and crystallizers. And this is where our technology today is mainly used in the field. Now, summarizing the benefits that we see, the usage of polymers will allow us to drive down the costs of this technology fairly quickly. And then we will take the full benefit not using high alloyed steels with all the problems around corrosions and costs. So the typical MD modules will consist out of polypropylene and the hydrophobic membrane, which is made out of of Teflon. The engineering will be a benefit as well. We see similar effects happening compared to RO because of the modular concepts of the MD modules. The small footprint and the very robust process that we can run will support engineering as well. The energy side has been discussed already, but it's very important to say that 90% of the energy needed is the thermal part, and so the cogeneration with waste heat streams or other cheaply available heat sources is key for all thermal processes. The environment, we see that at Memphis as a big advantage, because whatever trials we run, we foresee that the amount of chemical pretreatment will be significantly lower compared to RO or other thermal processes. Due to the mentioned points, especially the raw materials used. And all of these points will add up to very, very low OPEX figures, but also the CAPEX figures, which are definitely at the high end for time being, will come down significantly. That is given by the nature of production and choosing materials. Now I will close my presentation with a quick overview on applications where we are today. We do trials with ConocoPhillips in Qatar, concentrating brine from desalination plants. A similar aspect is the driver for Grünbeck here in Germany. QFS is a South African company active in desalination and also treating water from the mining industry, where we see very, very high salt concentrations. We completed some projects in co-generation with solar in Singapore, in Spain, mm-hmm. and with concentrated photovoltaics with IBM. These trials ran very successfully, and they showed a very, very attractive market potential for remote locations, island locations, and the general the combination with sustainable energy sources. The last picture is from one of our licensees, Aquavia in the Netherlands. This is a typical configuration where we have two trains of modules in a stackable design. One of these module blocks has a performance of 5 to 10 cubic meters per day. This is the performance is always related to the boundary conditions and to the quality of the feed water. But I think this picture indicates nicely the potential of scaling up this technology easily. And with this last slide, I close my presentation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Gert. That was a very interesting presentation about your manifestation of this technology using the vacuum effect. We now want to move into a question and answer session. So any attendees who have questions that they would like to put to the panel, you should be typing those into the Q&A box, and then we will see those questions appear while we're having our panel discussion. I might like just to start things off by just picking up this issue of energy usage. Clearly, we heard from Jim's presentation at the start that the energy usage of membrane distillation is relatively high. Of course, in desalination, we have a hierarchy of energies, with electrical energy at the top being very expensive, high-temperature thermal energy being somewhat less expensive further down the hierarchy. And then at the bottom of the hierarchy, we have low-temperature heat, waste heat, and ultimately even free heat. So given that, I mean, you were saying, Jim, in your presentation that your view was that you would get better efficiencies to push temperatures up in the membrane distillation system in order to get better GORs, better efficiency. How do you think that stacks up, though, against the fact that as you push those temperatures up, you're going to be paying, you may be gaining efficiency, but you may be using more expensive energy in order to do that, and so it may be that the cost advantage isn't there if you do that. Do you have a comment on that, Jim?
Yes, I do. Am I on? Yes, I think I am. This is always an imponderable question. High efficiency at a high energy unit cost or low efficiency at a less expensive. And as I said in one of my slides, when that option is available, the choice is almost always gone toward the higher cost, more efficient system. For years and years, people have talked about driving thermal systems with waste heat, use of solar ponds, use of low-temperature solar thermal collectors. None of them have come to fruition. And I think part of the reason for that is the so-called waste heat may be waste, but it's not free. By that, I don't mean that somebody is charging you by the joule. I mean that you have to extract that heat, and you have to move it around, and you have to move it efficiently through heat exchangers. And if you're talking small delta T's through heat exchangers, you end up increasing your heat exchanger surface area. So I think it's important when looking at any waste heat application to make sure that all heat exchangers, for example, on your heat input end, have been carefully sized and material selected and costed, because you're going to have to pay for retrieving that waste heat. If you look at the sort of a pie chart of any typical current desalination system, you'll find that the annual costs are roughly one-third energy, one-third capital recovery, and one-third other operating costs. And if you try to shrink the energy cost slice of the pie, the danger is that you have overlooked something which is going to increase the first cost part of the pie. And this is only looking at it historically. The future may be different. But I think the point I was trying to make is that the simplest designs of membrane distillation, which are heat recovery systems, cannot be pushed terribly far. And that in order to make further increases, you have to either accept the desirability of operating at higher top-end temperatures, or go to something like a multi-effect system, which we've shown, which does not operate under the same set of constraints.
Okay, there's some good points there, Jim. One of the technologies I mentioned in my very first introduction was evaporation, and one of the ways in which you make that energy efficient is that because you're operating under vacuum pressure, actually the low temperature heat is a useful thermal source for you. And I just wonder whether, Gertz, I wonder if I could address this question to you, that does the fact that you're using vacuum effect membrane distillation, is that pushing you perhaps to take benefit from lower temperature sources? I just wonder whether there's an analogy there with evaporation, because it certainly in evaporation it makes a big difference by the lower you take the vacuum pressure, the lower has to be your heat source on the feed side to make the process work.
Well, certainly.
Yes. I'm sorry.
Who's on here?
Yeah, so if Gertz could just answer,
okay, yes,
or make a first answer to that, and then maybe, Jim, you could come back.
Yes, certainly. I think, Graham, that is one of the drivers for the idea. The benefits are clear and the limitations are clear as well. So if you want to drive this process to success, you need to carefully look at the most efficient existing thermal technology, which is MED. So to apply vacuum to the system, we see this as a key and core principle to drive this process successfully. And we see that, and most of our customers and trial systems today exactly use this benefit by either providing these low-grade temperatures from any kind of heat source, or the connection with solar energy.
Right. And Val, have you got any comments that you'd like to add on energy usage from the sort of the engineering firm's viewpoint?
From the engineering standpoint, as an engineer, so engineering consultant firms, we're looking really not exactly the technology in the first round, we're looking for solution. So when we see the project or we're developing the project, we look in the needs and we look in how, what the best way to solve those needs or deliver or fulfill those needs. And we need to look on the long term with and a consideration always beside the technical, economical, its reliability and long term experience with the different systems. And that it's not regarding just membrane distillation, but it's any technology. And I used to be with Xenon developing MBR, and we went through that cycle as well. So the membrane distillation is a very promising technology, and I think we need to look at closer, but there is a certain step when until it may really become the commercial and, if I may say, a commodity technology like the same MAD or IRR, reverse osmosis, became lately. So I see the certain niche in MD technology, and as I mentioned, the combination with our processes or technology, what I meant, it may be combined with others. And one of idea, I just didn't spell that, but people already alluded that it's using the vacuum to intensify process, because the actually the MD process has certain theoretical limitation in terms of hydrodynamics. And that is true for thermal processes, other thermal processes. And actually, I want to address in that one of the questions, how large someone posted question to me, how large do you see the MD plan becoming? And the answer probably would be depends what type of application you're looking at. Like Gotts did show in his diagram, one of the niche, it's more using that as the more like a concentrator, not a water producer, as MD technology, it doesn't depend, or I would say probably less dependent on osmotic power. And that was the highest cost of the treatment occurs. So when we're going from the RO through the thermal processes and to the crystallization processes. So it's really where you look and where the application is. So in terms of if looking, I probably redirect your question, just answer to question they posed to me. If we're looking for water producers as AMD as a water producer from the salty water, it could be a good niche for smaller community where the energy cost may be high by a hotter climate, and you can use the waste heat somewhere around if it's a really waste, or you have a lot of sun and you can use the solar heat to create a thermal difference. Or another niche could be some heavy industrial or oily application where the water, the really every gram or pound or liter of the water when you extract it from the stream is important and expensive when using other processes. And as MD is a robust process and less dependent on osmotic power, that is really what hits IRO. The higher feed water TDS, the more that you hit IRO because you need to overcome osmotic power.
Yeah, so I mean that I think that's the sort of the zero liquid discharge and the brine concentration.
Yeah.
That's a
yeah.
subject I want to come back to that. But just on the energy, perhaps Albert, if I can pose a question to you, you put up a slide which showed potentially very low water costs. And I've got a question here on the panel which says, with those very low projected water costs that you were showing, why haven't membrane distillation installations made more progress? Why hasn't there been a better uptake of commercial installations?
Yep, that's a very good question. What I've seen up to now is that companies who come with those products on the market still have to buy those membranes in small scales. For that reason, the membranes are still expensive compared to reverse osmosis membranes.
Yeah, so it needs the market to really start expanding and volume.
Yes.
I think.
There's only a market when it is a proven technology. What I now see is that there are not many commercial units yet, because most of the membrane distillation equipment and installations are still under development. MAN is still optimizing their module designs and their energy consumptions, so there is still not a large production of a standardized product. Well, for that reason, those demonstration projects are even reasonably expensive.
So what would you say, Albert, how far away do you think commercial sort of mainstream is for MD?
Well, commercial application, one has to be convinced that not only the advantages on the short term are there, but that the technology will work for 3, 4, maybe 10 years even in water production companies. And so I expect that we, at least for the first 5 years, we will still see reasonable small-scale applications, most of them in the industry, and reasonable small is, let's say, a maximum 10 cubic meters an hour.
Okay. So I've got a question came in here about the effect of oil and grease. And in fact, during the presentations, I was thinking that the oil and gas industry may well be a very strong source of good applications, because you quite often get highly saline waters in those industries, and purifying those streams and especially desalting them is difficult. So they're not, in some cases they are produced waters, so they're both highly saline and potentially oil contaminated. So the question is, what is the influence of oil and grease on the membranes? Perhaps I could pose that one to Dirk.
Yes, I would like to take that one. It's generally, oil and grease is, or let's say, oils and surfactant are the two substances which harm the hydrophobic effect of the membranes. To a certain extent, you can treat it, but usually it turns the hydrophobic membrane into an hydrophilic membrane. So. That is the general answer. There are already oleophobic membranes available on the market, and they are commercially available. And for these specific markets and for these specific questions, we can use these oleophobic membranes. They have a negative effect on the flux. But given the problems which or the problematic on the seawater source, this reduction in flux is accepted in the market.
Sort of picking up on that then, with those oleophobic membranes, could you address, you know, someone is asking here that are there any examples of produced water treatment with membrane distillation? And it sounds like you're saying that with oleophobic membranes you could do, but it hasn't happened yet. Is that fair?
We had a large evaluation together with a Singaporean university on oleophobic membranes. Not in the field. The produced waters that we treat today, they do not contain any oils or oil amounts which can harm the standard hydrophobic membranes. But if we would be confronted with higher contaminated produced waters, then we would choose the oleophobic membranes. So far, the market that we are in and the trials that we run did not make this necessary.
I noticed that you were commenting that two possible membrane types were polypropylene and PTFE. Is that correct? I mean, I would think that there's quite a bit of difference in price, isn't there, with the polypropylene being relatively cheap and the PTFE being relatively expensive.
Unfortunately, that's not the case. Well, two quick questions on the membranes. There is no specific membrane for membrane distillation. The membranes that you can buy today on the market are not made for water treatment at all. They are for air filtration, dust filtration, textile. So we need to buy in what is available on the market, and that is the standard, and that is the cheapest source that we have today, a PTFE membrane from the standard suppliers. There are certain developments towards other membranes made out of polypropylene eventually, but let's say the best cost effects that we foresee when getting into larger volumes are definitely from PTFE.
Oh, okay. So more promise from that. Okay, so I've got a question here about brine concentration and zero liquid discharge. Albert, I wonder if you could field this question, talking about your membrane process, and could you say a little bit more about that and what you think the prospects for highly concentrated saline solution recovery is?
Yes, the state-of-the-art technology is evaporation of the water, and that is a very costful operation. So any advantage of other technologies, for instance, by membrane distillation using waste heat, could reduce the cost. And for that reason, we started this research, and the problem is that if you do with a normal membrane distillation process, as I showed in my second slide, you will get scaling on the membrane. And then the membrane closes completely and zero flux occurs. So there are several opportunities to reduce the precipitation conditions on the surface of the membrane compared to the bulk. And we're doing research with adding seeding crystals, which enhance crystallization processes, and we try to influence the process conditions in the bulk in such a way that the oversaturation in the bulk is higher than on the surface of the membrane, and that's the strategy we are now following.
Right. So one of the things that's been pointed out is, I mean, we've got flat sheet membranes within the commercial products at the moment. I mean, that is correct, isn't it? I mean, Gertz, your system showed the foil and the flat sheet. I mean, in other membrane processes, they normally start out as flat sheet, and then they evolve into more cost-effective, high-surface area formats, ultimately hollow fiber from the point of view of packing density and cost and so on. What do you think might happen in membrane distillation, or do you think that the flat sheet has got special sort of process efficiencies and benefits?
Yeah, the people within MEMSIS have spent some good part of their life, up to 25 years, in membrane distillation, and we evaluated the other potentials of hollow fiber and spiral, especially spiral wound configurations, carefully before. Actually, the beginning of MEMSIS was in spiral wound, and then we turned into flat sheet. because we believe today that the adding of vacuum to the system and the energy recovery, or let's say the, plus the multi-effect configuration allows this flat sheet configuration only. Maybe we find something else in a couple of years, but we thought about it now for quite some time, and we couldn't find a better configuration for now.
What do you think, Albert, from your perspective on terms of the format and configuration of the membrane?
I'm still not sure which configuration will win in the end. It has all to do with the lowest production cost, which can be highly automated. So I'm not sure. We started with flat sheet membranes, but it could be spiral wound in the end.
Right. So I've got a question here, which is about possibly developing hybrid applications in which membrane distillation is linked in with other membrane or desalination technologies. Do you think there's any prospect for further efficiencies by doing that?
Well, I think the membrane distillation crystallization is an example for this.
Yeah.
Right.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. And if I might add at this point, when we talk about desalination, usually everybody jumps onto seawater desalination and large volume applications, and that became clear from the presentations and some of the questions of the attendees. The largest systems that are currently under design are in the range of 100 to 200 cubic meter per day. We see the huge potential already at this level on the industrial brine management market. And this is desalination as well, just on higher concentrations. So
yeah.
the combination with RO, like taking RO brine into our system, is something that we see, or that we are being asked from a lot of market players.
Do you think that the technology therefore has got maybe a special opportunity in emergency relief or disaster response type provision?
Well, I would position this more on the standard desalination level, and not necessarily in combination with RO. But yes, we have some customers and licensees who are aiming into this market. Yes.
Okay. So you've said that the focus is probably at the small end. I guess as the take up happens and the costs come down, you'll see an expansion to higher flows. I mean, do you think that that's possible?
Absolutely. So
you don't think that the energy issue, so you could argue it both ways, actually. Maybe that would be better to go large, because then, I mean, Jim was saying that the cost of recovering heat from low temperature sources is quite expensive, but then maybe if you do it at a big enough scale, then the capital costs of doing that become less relative to the energy that you're recovering.
That is very right, and we foresee this, and we have this clearly in our development plans with our partners. But more important, I think that the higher the concentration problematic of the feedwater becomes, the the lesser the role, well, the energy is always important, but it is not like the key driver that they need. In a lot of industries, especially in the oil and gas or in the pharmaceutical, they are such problematic feed waters that they just need a technical solution to treat the water. The cost comes second. There are a lot of markets in the world where the LD becomes an obligation, and regulations clearly drive towards zero liquid discharge. And then brine management becomes more important, and then thermal separation is often the only solution.
Do we have time? Yeah, it's Val.
Yeah, hello, Val. Yes, you got a comment there?
Yeah, I do have a comment. It's all good discussion. Just to add to that, I just scroll in the questions, and many people asking how big the system could be, when it will become commercial, and so on. And there is a certain rules how technology commercializing, and we can see in the past few decades how IRA commercialized, how MED process commercialized, how low pressure membranes processes commercialized. Actually, technology needs to find really the good niche when it really becomes effective comparing to the current processes. And I think that remote small locations or concentration of the concentrates, particular for industries, those are places where we still have an open niche for competition, particularly in the industry. When we using RO, we ended up with the RO permit. We tried to use secondary brine concentrate RO, and we are limited by saturation indices, and we need high pressure to run those. And next solution, usually the crystallizer, which is extremely, or concentrator, which is extremely expensive and energy intensive process. And that is one of the niche where MD can really play in.
Hmm. Okay. And if I could just draw this together with a final technical question, and just putting this back over to you, Jim, initially. There's a question that's come in. What sort of preferred temperature range do you think that membrane distillation should operate at? You've said that the lower the temperature, the lower the efficiency. You would like to see it pushed to higher temperature. What do you think that temperature, that optimum temperature range might be?
I'd turn it around a little bit. I would suggest that the researchers in membrane distillation plug into their models a higher top-end temperature, let's say 95°C or something like that, and see how much that improves their performance. And looking at that improved performance, see what new applications that might open. In other words, I'm answering your question, but I'm saying look at it backwards.
Yes.
I think you'd find that would open more applications, and that would give you more targets to pursue. Now, one other thing I'd like to add was this in response to a question that appeared on the Q&A. Tyler Algill asked why MSF and MED recovery rates are so much lower than seawater RO. And the answer, part of that, in my table of rates, I did an all-in water intake as W. And for both MSF and MED, a lot of water is used just for cooling, and it's not actually what you might call process water. If you look at MSF recirculating mode, the most common, the heat reject stage is usually the lower three temperatures. They pump an awful lot of water through them and right back to the sea, and it's really only used for heat reject. So the processes might you know, ideally be considered as having lower, but I didn't higher recovery rates, but I didn't think it was fair. I took the all in.
Right.
And if I could make one more response to another question again by Tyler, he asked and this is in terms of membrane distillation, what percentage of energy costs are associated with applying a vacuum? That's a very good question because our costs associated with it. And how is a vacuum applied? Is it through a mechanical pump or through a steam ejector system or how? And that is supposed to be a question back to Gert, sir.
Yes, I was wanting to just highlight that one as well because obviously in the evaporation process I keep referring back to vacuum is key, and how you cost effectively create the vacuum has a massive influence on the economics of evaporation. So Gert, maybe you could just field that question for us.
Yes, in the system setup that we use, we have a very, very tiny vacuum pump to evacuate the system during the starting phase.
Yeah.
And then we have the condenser, which means that we need to provide a cold end, whether this is 25, 30 degree feed water running through the condenser, providing the cold end, and this condenser provides the vacuum for the process. So actually the cost to keep up the vacuum during the process are they are not zero, but they are negligible as long as we have a cold site available.
Yeah, because of the you're creating your vacuum by condensation basically.
As long
as you've got a cool enough source.
Exactly.
In a very hot environment, are you not then a bit limited?
We are, but that again, that is a question that for which some partners have the answer to combine our process with a vapor compressor, for instance. And with this, we can overcome. We can overcome the missing cold site. Yes.
Yeah. And did you, Gert, have any comment on what you would see as the ideal sort of top temperature that you would like membrane distillation to operate at?
Yeah. We like to run our systems at the moment around 80, 85 degrees, but the more problematic the water becomes and the more nasty ingredients are in, we reduce the temperature to avoid scaling in the module, of course. Now, generally, the chosen materials will allow us to run the process at higher temperatures as well. So therefore, I would fully agree to Jim's comment. We have this on our list. Nevertheless, in the commercialization phase in which we are today, we focus a little bit more on the customers that we have are happy with the flux rate that we provide. We need to make sure that and prove in field trials that the process is robust enough, and the life cycle of the membrane, that is something where a lot of work and reference systems are needed to convince the conservative water industry about this process.
Albert, is there anything you'd like to add as a final comment before I finally wrap up?
No, I've one comment on the higher temperatures.
Yeah.
Within TNO, we're now doing research on very high temperatures. We go over the 100 degrees. And we think that that gives lots of new opportunities next to dewatering. You could also think of energy production.
Hmm.
So that's my last comment.
Okay. Well, I think we've come to the end of our time. Thank you very much to the panelists for joining me on this webinar, and thank you very much for the attendees for signing in. There will be available proceedings from the webinar through the organizer. So thank you very much once again for attending, and I hope we've shed a bit of light on what the prospects are for membrane distillation after 40 years of research. Thank you very much. Goodbye.